Hi friends, this is Mark Earhart for Point of Discovery. In our last episode, we previewed an upcoming story about a computer model for a living cell. We'll release that episode soon, but we wanted to acknowledge that, for many listeners, daily life has changed due to the coronavirus pandemic. During this unusual time, when it's harder to connect physically with important people in our lives, it can be helpful to spend a little time thinking about the things that still bind us together. For one, science and the natural world remain full of wonders. With spring beginning and a lot of health clubs closed, more people are getting outside, looking around, and taking in a larger world than the one we normally focus on. What's more, many of us are taking notice of the ways that experts can help us through this challenging time. They'll tell us that the same natural world that served up our current crisis also offers our best hope. That's true in the context of this virus and more. For example, understanding the virus's true nature is step one for creating treatments and vaccines. Also, understanding human beings will be important to help us cope with the consequences of the social distancing developments. With these in mind, we've put together a compilation from our previous episodes that we hope will help you find some solace right now in rediscovering life, the people we're closest with, and the universe. We bring you four examples to provide some respite, or maybe gentle reminders from moments in our archive related to the curiosity, beauty, insights, and wonder of discovery. First, we'll begin with a journey back to our very first episode when we explored a link that binds almost all life here on Earth. We visited a scientific team that, using genes, discovered how closely we're related even to simple life, whose evolutionary path we diverged with probably a billion years ago. Meet our evolutionary cousins, yeast. They're the underappreciated workhorses that fluff up our bread and turn plain old fruit juice and starches into adult beverages.
Okay, so we'll go walk about.
So we'll walk about. Yeah, so this would be
It turns out our bond with yeast runs a lot deeper than bread and beer, as I found out when I visited the lab of Edward Marcotte.
So this would be a typical molecular biology laboratory. So there's a long series of benches, and there's a lot of instruments for manipulating tiny, tiny amounts of liquid, like little tiny bits of DNA, and there's lots of petri dishes stacked up with cells growing on them and lots of vials with colored liquid.
Marcotte is a professor of molecular biosciences at the University of Texas at Austin and co-director of the Center for Systems and Synthetic Biology.
And what we would have would be typically petri dishes covered in tiny little dots. So the petri dishes would be filled with something that helps the yeast cells grow. So if you imagine chicken broth and gelatin, it's basically something akin to that, although we don't use chicken broth and gelatin. And the cells grow in little colonies, little bumps on the surface. And here you can smell one.
Oh, that sounds, or smells like socks or something.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
So he says these tiny dots of yeast are actually a lot more like you and me than you'd think.
Our own genes, so humans, although we look nothing like a yeast cell, share thousands of genes with yeast cells, and they're recognizable. We can look at a human gene and we can recognize a precise equivalent in the genome of a yeast cell. And this is because a billion years ago, we had a common ancestor way, 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 way back in the dawn of time. And so we'd like to know if these genes really work the same way.
Marcotte says of the thousands of genes that humans and yeast share, about 450 are critical for the survival of the yeast. That life or death element, you have the gene, you live, you don't have the gene, you die, is a powerful tool to test whether our genes do the same thing that their genes do. So here's what Marcotte and his team did. They created hundreds of genetically engineered strains of yeast, which they call humanized yeast. Each strain had a disabled yeast gene, plus a human version of the gene that they could either turn on or off. The human gene acted like a sort of kill switch.
And then we could turn off the human gene, the cell should die, unless we turn on the human gene, in which case we could test to see whether the cells were capable of living if provided with the active human gene. And that was the essence of the test.
It all sounds pretty simple, but for each gene pair, they tested it with the human gene on, with the human gene off, and with control groups. And to be sure of their results, they essentially tested every gene pair in three different ways. All of that added up to thousands of mini-experiments over about 4 years. Ashik Khatru is a postdoctoral researcher who ran the experiments.
So this was a crazy experiment, and we had no idea whether it will work. It will be complete failure, or it would have been a complete success. In this case, it was a great success.
The researchers found that about half of the 450 yeast strains could grow and reproduce with just the human version of a critical gene.
And so it was remarkable that half of them were really doing the same thing. I mean, it's sort of the incredible testament to the sort of stability over a billion years of time of these systems, and that they argues that in both humans and yeast, they're really doing pretty much the same thing that they were doing in their ancestor a billion years ago.
Our second excerpt offers some practical advice for our current situation. Many of us are spending a lot more time with our significant others than ever, due to social distancing practices that are keeping us at home with immediate family and partners. In 2017, we spoke with Lisa Neff, a faculty member in the Department of Human Development and Family Sciences, about the elements necessary to keep couples' relationships strong, including through stressful times. First, she talked about the health benefits of high-quality relationships.
So for instance, there was a really great study a couple years ago in the Journal of Clinical Oncology looking at cancer survival rates. And they found that married patients had a 20% greater chance of survival upon diagnosis than single patients did. But what was more astonishing to the medical researchers was that the survival benefits provided by marriage were greater than the survival benefits provided by chemotherapy. So our relationships really matter.
Wow. That is really dramatic.
It was a pretty dramatic finding. But further research suggests it's not just get married and suddenly you'll have fantastic health. The quality of your marriage matters a lot too. You have to think about, is that marriage functioning well? Is it happy and fulfilling? So for instance, another study was looking at patients who had a heart attack and found that individuals in a happier, healthier, less hostile relationship were more likely to survive the heart attack compared to patients in less happy and less fulfilling marriages. And even more astonishing, there was a meta-analysis. And so meta-analysis is just, let's aggregate a whole bunch of scientific findings in the field to sort of get a collection of what is going on in the state of science. And what they found was that people who have high quality close family relationships had a 50% greater chance of survival than people who have poor quality relationships.
Survival, what do you mean? Just in life
in
general?
In life, just a greater, more a lower mortality risk, essentially in life, yes. And what was even more astonishing was they compared the effect of our social relationships to other types of common, well-known factors that influence our mortality risk. And they found that the effect of our social relationships on our mortality risk was even greater than things such as smoking behavior, physical inactivity, and obesity. So our relationships matter, and they matter in some pretty important ways. So as a society, if we care about keeping people happy and healthy and reducing healthcare costs and having people function well in society, we need to care about the quality of their close relationships.
Neff told me that for newlyweds, the adjustment to married life can be really hard. In fact, the risk for divorce is highest just 2 to 3 years into marriage. If newlyweds get hit with some external stress, say one of them loses a job or has to take care of a sick parent, the way they interact with each other can easily take a dark turn.
When your partner lets you down or snaps at you, our initial gut instinct is to snap back, right? It's more of a destructive response. And so being a good relationship partner means inhibiting that destructive response, taking a pause, and enacting a more positive response in return. When we're stressed out, when we had a hard day at work, when we're dealing with, you know, trying to figure out how to pay the bills, we're dealing with all these outside stressors, when we come home to our partner, we just have less energy and resources to do those good things in the relationship. So our communication tends to suffer. We're less likely to give our partner the benefit of the doubt when they do something annoying to us or are a little bit snippy with us. And so stress can sort of gradually erode those positive relationship processes, making it more difficult for the relationship to thrive.
Based on your research, what do you advise for newlyweds? How do you sum that up?
And yeah, there are a few avenues that could help couples. It is difficult if stress is taxing all your resources for the person who's stressed out to overcome that. So I would suggest for the partner of the stressed out individual to be a little bit more aware of the stress levels in the relationship. And if you know your partner is going through a particularly stressful time at work, maybe cut them a little slack when they're snippy with you or they let you down, they forget to bring the milk home like they promised, whatever it may be. Just remember that the stress level is having an impact on them, and perhaps be a little bit more forgiving, be, you know, a little bit more, give them the benefit of the doubt. Also, it can be helpful if couples, and this can be difficult to do when couples are especially dealing with serious stressors like unemployment or whatnot, but to the extent possible, try to incorporate as many small shared positive moments together, small moments of laughter, taking time to have a leisure activity together, because an accumulation of those small positive moments can really have a beneficial effect when negative events do happen in the relationship, and they can help reduce the impact of that negativity if you have accumulated some of those shared positive moments with one another.
And now for our third segment, something different. A great deal of nature's wonder and beauty here on this planet happens out of sight, in the ocean's depths. Here, we include a complete episode about one population of ocean dwellers that have a unique way of grabbing attention. Gulf corvina look pretty ordinary. They're a couple of feet long and silvery. It's their sound that sets them apart. That chorus you're hearing is made by millions of fish, and it's what makes the Gulf corvina one of the wonders of the natural world. It's also why they're threatened. But with the help of science, the sounds they make might be the key to saving them. This is Point of Discovery. I'm Mark Earhart. Gulf corvina live in only one place in the world, the Gulf of California. They're a popular fish eaten across Mexico during the season of Lent. A decade ago, the Mexican government asked marine biologist Brad Arisman and his colleagues from the Gulf of California Marine Program to study the corvina. They were worried that heavy fishing might cause the population to collapse. Arisman had heard that the fish make loud sounds, so one of the first things he did was borrow an underwater microphone, or hydrophone, from some of his colleagues who study communication in whales and dolphins.
So we went out there a couple times and got the sounds. We were excited because we were right on top of the corvina and we're all cheering. And we had this thing in the water, and we go back and the graduate student who worked with marine mammals said, "Something's wrong with this hydrophone. It's clipping, which means it's flatlining. It doesn't record all the data. Something's wrong with the hydrophone because it's just stopping at 160 decibels or 170 decibels, and there's no way fish are that loud."
Eventually, they turned down the sensitivity of their equipment, and Arisman's graduate student, Timothy Rowell, discovered that these fish can make sounds up to 192 decibels. Enough to make your eardrums rupture, or possibly even kill you, if it were happening on land.
It's louder than a rock concert. It's louder than standing less than a meter to a chainsaw.
The males are the only ones who make this sound, using their swim bladders, which are like balloons full of air that help them stay afloat. Strong muscles around their swim bladders produce the sounds. It's kind of like putting your hands around a balloon and twisting.
And it It just sounds like screaming, and that's what it is. These fish are literally screaming.
Several times each spring, around the new and full moons, the entire species, millions of fish, migrate to the northernmost tip of the Gulf of California. That's when the change from high tide to low tide is the largest.
And then right when the tide starts to drain out, all the males start calling. And so it's what we call chorusing. You can hear it's this constant pulsing and chorusing of these males.
Love-struck males are making all this racket so the females can find them in the murky water. It's the equivalent of karaoke night at the local singles bar. It's a chaotic swirl of thousands to millions of fish, and it is loud. The sound is boosted even further because they're packed into underwater canyons.
Clearly, it's not just the fish, but the environment they're living in that's magnifying the sound and producing these ungodly, unheard of levels of sound.
But all this noise is dangerous. It's a dead giveaway to people who fish. The calls are so loud, fishers can hear them right through their boats. Each spring, they go out a couple of nights before a new or full moon and cruise around until they hear the loudest sounds.
The fishermen can literally drop their nets. They have a single net, and they have a 25, 26-foot boat, 2 to 3 per people. They drop that net, and they can fill up at least 2 tons of fish in less than 10 to 15 minutes. And then the rest of the time is pulling that net in, and then they just drive back with a boat that literally is barely above water, and sometimes they sink, and they can make their whole catch, and then they're done.
So a typical fisher goes out for a few days every couple of weeks, and each time, the actual fishing takes about as long as it takes to listen to this audio story.
So basically about 20, 25 days of fishing, they get up to 6,000 metric tons of fish with little fiberglass boats. So it's incredible. So the fishing and the spawning are completely synchronized. These fish come in, they spawn with the outgoing tide, and the fishermen concentrate their efforts specifically on that timing.
It's a ritual that's played out as reliably as the change of seasons and the phases of the moon for as many years as people have sought a meal here. Until recently, Corvina populations have been pretty steady, but there's been a big uptick in fishing in the last 20 years. It's become a major source of fish across Mexico during the season leading up to Easter, Lent. Because the whole species spawns in one place, if this fishery collapses, that's it. It could take decades to recover, if ever.
So yeah, everyone's really concerned about whether this massive continual harvest of the species is sustainable.
It's not like those doing the fishing want this fishery to collapse. They just want a reliable source of income for their families.
The fishermen are by no means the enemy here. They're actually the ones who have provided us all the information and access to the resource, and they're the ones that are most interested in sustainability.
Just as the loud calls of the male corvina make them an easy target for the fishing industry, the calls might be the key to saving them from extinction. Arisman and his colleagues wondered if they could use the sounds as a way to monitor when and where the fish are spawning and how many there are. Unfortunately, there are limitations with sound.
If you ever go in your pool and have someone scream at you, you know it's you can't figure out whether they're in front of you or in back of you. And so we have these underwater microphones, they call hydrophones, that do listen to the sound, but targeting the source and the distance and how many fish is not trivial.
Since a loud sound that's far away can sound the same as a quieter sound that's closer to the microphone, Arisman and his team needed a way to calibrate the sound intensity data from the hydrophones with another type of technology to count exactly how many fish are in an area. That technology is sonar. Sonar is more expensive and complicated to interpret than sound intensity data, but he only needs it for calibration.
If you can find a very strong, predictable relationship between those two different independent measurements, now you got something. Now you can imagine a situation, if it's predictable, you can just have the underwater microphones out there, and you can use it as a way to monitor how many fish are there, because you know this sort of sound intensity and this loudness corresponds to about this many fish. And then you have this very powerful monitoring capability.
Arisman and his colleagues recently finished calibrating sound intensity data for the Corvina. Their international research group, the Gulf of California Marine Program, has created an interactive online tool called Data Mares, where anyone can study how Corvina populations have changed from year to year since the early 1990s. And those who fish, fisheries managers, and conservationists, can now do a better job of keeping Corvina populations sustainable.
The idea is what we try to bring all the stakeholders, different groups that have a stake in the fishery and the environment together to work it out. And it's nice that science is playing a role in that.
Arisman's research is laying the groundwork for protecting other fish who spawn in large groups. Based at the University of Texas Marine Science Institute in Port Aransas, he is now applying the same methods to another fish closer to home, the spotted sea trout. It's one of the most commercially important fish along the Texas Gulf Coast. For our fourth and final segment, we take an even more zoomed-out view of nature. Way, way out. One of science's most thrilling moments in recent years is one we've discussed a few times on this podcast. The discovery of gravitational waves by an international scientific collaboration called LIGO, first mentioned in our episode, Cosmic Car Wreck. In February 2016, David Reitze, the University of Texas at Austin alumnus who heads LIGO, got to tell the world,
ladies and gentlemen, we have detected gravitational waves. We did it.
When very massive objects in space, such as black holes or neutron stars, smash into each other, they send waves through the fabric of space. Gravitational waves are like the ripples on a pond that you make when you toss a stone in. They were predicted more than a century ago by Albert Einstein. Detecting them gives astronomers and physicists a whole new way of interacting with and learning from the cosmos. Again, David Reitze.
If you try and think about what we know about the universe from a physicist's standpoint, you know, we have big colliders, you know, that collide subatomic particles. We have telescopes that look at, you know, optical signals. Now, gravitational waves are fundamentally different, all right? In some sense, they're a new sector, all right, with which to look at the universe. And they can tell us things about the universe that no other sector can.
This subject also came up last year as we sat down with scientists to talk about their favorite elements in the periodic table. Have you ever wondered where gold came from? Believe it or not, gravitational waves are part of the story. Physicist Aaron Zimmerman is part of LIGO, a big science project that has been listening for rumbles in the universe that make time and space quiver like a plucked guitar string, what are known as gravitational waves. In August 2017, LIGO's gravitational wave detectors caught for the first time two superdense objects called neutron stars smashing into each other.
What we think happened was we had these two superdense objects, let's say for the sake of argument, 11 kilometers across and with more mass than is in our sun in them, so a density that you can't imagine, and they're whipping around each other at 10% the speed of light. The kinds of speeds that you can't even imagine as they whirl and whirl around each other. And then finally they collide together and there's a blast.
The explosion released a blue-white fireball of unimaginable heat and matter. It was so hot and dense that it created some of the heaviest elements in the universe, like platinum, uranium, and gold.
It turns out that by observing this radioactive fireball, how brightly it glowed, how hot it was, how quickly it faded, astronomers were able to estimate how much material was in that fireball coming off this collision. And from that, they were able to deduce that there was a lot of heavy elements produced. In fact, many times Earth's mass worth of gold was produced. I was looking at a paper just now trying to get a better number for this call, and between 15 and 70 Earth masses is what one team estimates is the amount of gold that was produced in this event.
Good grief. That's a lot of gold.
And that's just one component, right? In addition, this was making platinum, uranium, all of these elements at the top of the periodic table basically were being manufactured in this fireball.
Astronomers think that neutron star collisions like this, as well as some exploding stars called supernovas, created most of the heavy elements in the universe.
It would have been mixed in with all the other gases and dust of the galaxy, and eventually, when our own solar system was born out of the collapse of some cloud of gas, the trace bits of gold and so on that you know, accreted onto the Earth and that we can now find today would have come from exactly something like one of these collisions.
Wow. So if you have a gold ring on, you may actually have on your finger something that was created in a massive explosion billions of years ago.
Yes, evidence is pointing to the fact that the gold on your finger came from some extremely violent explosion or collision back in the earlier parts of our galaxy's history.
Wow, that's amazing.
Point of Discovery is a production of the University of Texas at Austin's College of Natural Sciences. To listen to the full episodes that we drew these excerpts from, and for a list of the music you heard in this episode, visit us on our website at pointofdiscovery.org. If you like what you heard, be sure and tell your friends. We're available wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Our senior producer is Christine Sinatra. I'm your host and producer, Mark Earhart. Thanks for listening.